Accession number 28353, Reel 11.
Peter, thank you very much for continuing with your contribution to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. I think that if we may, even though we're on a new tape, if we can continue really where we left off, please.
Yeah, okay. Well,
with
as
your
I,
next appointment.
I recall we had got to my tour as Air Officer Commanding One Group, which involved the move, the closing down of the headquarters at Upavon, moving the group to Benson, and having been there for a relatively short time, I was rung by the Commander-in-Chief of Strike Command, who at that stage was an Air Chief Marshal John Thompson, who said that I would be posted to the Ministry of Defence as the Assistant Chief of Air Staff. This involved short-touring me at Headquarters One Group, which was a significant disappointment because a command tour is, generally speaking, very much more enjoyable than a staff tour. However, I think Air Chief Marshal Thompson particularly wanted me in the Assistant Chief appointment for a variety of reasons. Not least, I think, we did get on extremely well, and he was fairly certain that he would be the next Chief of Air Staff, and I think he saw us again working together in partnership in that particular appointment. Sadly, that was not to come about because of his own tragic death shortly after relinquishing the job as Commander-in-Chief. He went to a NATO appointment and died very early on in that appointment and didn't ever get to be Chief of Air Staff, but I'm sure that was what was in his mind when he sort of said that that was where I was going, and indeed I have reason to believe that he persuaded the then Chief of Air Staff, who was an Air Chief Marshal, Mike Graydon, that I was the person to go into that job, although somebody else had been selected for it.
This is selected for ACDS?
The Assistant Chief of Air Staff, ACAS.
I'm sorry.
ACAS.
ACAS, Assistant Chief of Air Staff.
So the Chief of Air Staff at the time was Air Chief Marshal Graydon. He had been in post for a while. The Air Force was going through a particularly difficult time at this stage, and this would be August 94. It was the sort of the tail end of something called Defence Cost Studies.
I'm going to just stop if I may.
This was a particularly difficult time for the Royal Air Force in the aftermath of the Defence Cost Study. Difficult for a variety of reasons. Difficult because I think the Conservative government at the time was extremely keen to privatise so much of defence. Anything that wasn't a core activity was to be privatised and put out into civilian contract and so forth. And the Air Force was seen as a service that was over-heavy in terms of manpower by a number of people, not least a man called Walker, Air Marshal John Walker, who had left the service or was on his way out of the service, having retired from the post of Chief of Defence Intelligence with a grievance, with a chip on his shoulder, because he felt that he'd been overlooked and had not got the jobs that he believed he was qualified to do, and indeed maybe he was, and he clearly wanted to be Commander-in-Chief in Royal Air Force Germany. I suspect he would like to have been Commander-in-Chief Strike Command, and those aspirations had been frustrated, and so he went out of his way to try and persuade ministers that the Air Force structure was wrong, that it needed to be streamlined, modelled far more on the Israeli model, which wasn't appropriate for the Royal Air Force, because although one respects the Israeli Air Force hugely, it was an Air Force with no responsibilities outside of Israel, very small country, very clearly defined aims and so forth, and therefore could rely on a structure which was very frontline heavy, very small supporting overhead structure, no clearly, as I say, external responsibilities, and therefore a very different beast to the Royal Air Force. But a combination of Air Marshal Walker with one of the Secretary of State's special advisors, a chap called Mr. David Hart, working directly to Rifkin, who I did not think was a good Secretary of State for Defence for a great number of reasons, but not least because of his reliance on special advisors, which I thought went to an extreme and undermined severely the role of the Chiefs of Staff and indeed the Chief of Defence Staff. I saw special advisors sort of virtually overrule the then Chief of Defence Staff, Field Marshal Inge, in a way which I thought was quite disgraceful, but which was encouraged by Rifkin. So the Air Force are going through a very difficult time with, as I say, part of this strand of the Israeli model, Air Marshal Walker arguing very strongly that the F-3 Tornado, in which we had invested a great deal of money, was not the right aeroplane, that we needed to scrap that, buy F-16s off the shelf from America. Attractive in some respect, and he got quite a lot of support from some of the younger pilots, and again I think he was mischievous in that, in as much that he had a group of youngish Air Force officers that he would try and encourage and foment. But if we had gone down that route, there's no doubt in my mind that it would have undermined the program for Typhoon, the European fighter aircraft. So a very difficult time for the Air Force, and again I think this all therefore comes back to John Thompson, Air Chief Marshal Thompson, wanting to try and correct quite a lot of the things which had gone on during defence cost studies. Knowing that he was going to be Chief of Air Staff, he and I were undoubtedly closely aligned in our thinking about the Air Force, and he wanted me in place before he got there, to try and start a recovery program which he would then sort of almost orchestrate from his job at High Wycombe as a NATO commander. And although it was a great tragedy that he died, I think my time as the assistant chief prior to him arriving as a CAS would have actually been quite difficult, because I think he would have been on the phone the whole time saying, what's going on, what are you up to now, this is where we ought to be going, which might have given me a considerable conflict of interest when I was actually working for Mike Graydon, with his own ideas, of course, of where we should be going and things of that nature. So although I relished the chance of working for John Thompson again, because there's no doubt he would have been an extremely fine Chief of Air Staff, and I guess would have gone on to be a CDS as well, the prospect of him talking in one ear and Mike Graydon talking in the other was not one that I was actually thrilled about. But in the event, it didn't happen, because, say, John Thompson so very sadly died at very short notice.
Can I just ask one question? How did Air Marshal Walker get the ear of the government?
He had quite a high profile appointment as Chief of Defence Intelligence during Gulf War I in 91, that sort of time scale. So he was frequently briefing Secretary of State for Defence. He was frequently, I suspect, briefing the Prime Minister as well. So therefore he got access to ministers. He formed a close relationship with this chap, David Hart, who clearly was a very high profile. He had been involved with Thatcher, of course, during the miners' strike. He was now a key principal special advisor to Rifkin, and he and Walker formed a very good, close partnership. They were talking the same language, perhaps for slightly different reasons, but it was an amalgamation of effort which seemed to suit both of them. And that's really how he got his access. And we'll come back to one particular aspect which was headed off at the time, but it did present Mike Graydon with huge challenges, which he will have expressed to you far better, better than I.
And with interesting comments on Malcolm Rifkin, as he didn't hold back on Malcolm Rifkin on his tape.
No, I'm sure he didn't. He will have known him and the relationship far better than I. But from my aspect, sitting as his sort of number two in MOD, it wasn't a happy relationship, and frankly I didn't respect Rifkin as a Secretary of State at all. Frankly, he, in my view, was the worst Secretary of State I worked for in my various appointments in MOD. But that's, you know, you will get all sorts, and you know, he certainly is at the bottom of the pile as far as I'm concerned. But if we just talk about defence cost studies, because although the exercise had been completed, of course, before I got there as ACAS, it was done during the sort of the earlier part of 94, and I didn't get to MOD until August 94, we were having, as a service and as a staff in London, to cope with the aftermath of it. Within the MOD, a lot of reorganisation to give greater power to the centre under the Vice Chief of Defence Staff and the Second Permanent Under Secretary, and to reduce the level of dedicated support to the single service chiefs. And undoubtedly, with that, a loss of authority as well, and just a sort of a weakening of the position of the chiefs within the MOD centre. And just to give perhaps a sort of flavour of that, obviously Royal Air Force, all about air power, but airworthiness and the safety of flying and airworthiness, an very important function, delegated from the Secretary of State to the Chief of Air Staff, and a function retained in London and not devolved to the operational command. Two commands in those days, of course, well, three, training command, Germany, and strike command. But a function which was thought to be properly secured by separating it from the operators, because to give the operator the airworthiness function, we felt very strongly put them as both gamekeeper and potentially poacher in the same field, and therefore it was very important that airworthiness was kept away from the operating commands. But through the reorganisation of the air staff under the assistant chief, very difficult to persuade the centre that that wasn't a function that could be devolved. We didn't need dedicated staff to do that up in London, so, you know, severe cutting of the manpower, probably a cut of more than 50% of the air staff directly working to the assistant chief of air staff, combining the two major directorates, of which I had been a director previously during the Gulf War, sort of 1990-1991, when I was director of air offensive. I had that responsibility, and there was director air defensive who had a similar staff, and those were just sort of combined into one and cut by at least 50%, which made, as I say, providing advice and recommendations for the chief much more difficult. The second, I think, major reorganisation was the way in which operations were overseen through what was called Defence Cost Study 2, when we saw the formation of the permanent joint headquarters and the creation of the Chief of Joint Operations. This was something which actually the Royal Air Force objected to, and said that they didn't see this as being an effective way of going about the command of operations. And I think in hindsight we were wrong, but certainly John Thompson and myself, who'd all had experience at strike command over the previous sort of 5 or so years, felt that the system we had in place was perfectly all right. And thinks back to Gulf War I, a four-star commander for the operation was selected from the three operational commanders-in-chief. Sir Patrick Hind, CNC Strike Command, was selected as the joint force commander, and his headquarters at High Wycombe, the best underground headquarters in the United Kingdom at the time, was selected as the headquarters. It was reinforced by people from Northwood and from Wilton Army and Navy personnel to run the operation, and, you know, it was a great success. So why not use that model again, and if necessary, appoint the Commander-in-Chief Fleet to run an operation from Northwood, or the Commander-in-Chief Land to run it from Wilton, although his headquarters at Wilton was not as well, nearly as well equipped as Northwood or High Wycombe to do such a thing, but it could be. We had also, since Gulf War I, had done Operation Haven, which was the operation in sort of southern Turkey, northern Iraq, where all the Kurds rushed up into the hills once Saddam reasserted himself post the Gulf War I, and that again was commanded from High Wycombe, as was the original setting up of the no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq, again post Operation Haven, to keep Saddam Hussein off the back of the Kurds in the north and off the back of the Shias in the south. And again, both those operations largely air only, and therefore made sense to run them from High Wycombe.
Was this the time that the no-fly zones were established?
Yes, yes. Operation Jiral in the south, whereby the southern no-fly zone was also set up after the Shias revolted and Saddam put them down so brutally, and clearly had in mind to, you know, do even worse. And so we set up the no-fly zone in the south to protect their interests as well.
And the no-fly zone, obviously, Saddam Hussein could not operate aircraft, I assume, of any sort within the no-fly zone. But what about forces on the ground? Because he could still get rid of Shias or attack Kurds if he just drove army vehicles in them.
Yes, he could. That's correct. But he, and although he did a certain amount of that, and he dried up quite a lot of the marshes and so forth, the major concern was air, and of course eventually, when he, you know, he put in lots of surface-to-air missile systems into the southern no-fly zone, we eventually took those out because they, you know, represented a direct threat to the policing of the no-fly zones.
And so they were effective and operational even after Gulf War I. These would have worked.
Yes,
efficiently.
Yes. Yeah, and they did. I mean, they didn't do everything that the coalition wanted, but they did actually do a lot, and over time, a great deal of Saddam's ground-based air defence assets were taken out as a result. And of course, we then actually eventually went into Desert Fox, where we actually took out a lot more of his command and control facilities as well, because they were obviously having a major effect on our ability to fly in the no-fly zones. So although the no-fly zones went on for a very long time, what, 8-9 years, something of that nature, there were, within that period, a number of high-profile operations to either take down the surface-to-air missile defences or to take out further elements of his command and control system to make our ability to operate in the no-fly zones that much more secure.
Right.
But all of that in the early days had been commanded from High Wycombe, and it seemed to work well, so we couldn't see in the Royal Air Force why we needed to change. And again, we could see this as greater centralisation, less authority for the single services. But in hindsight, setting up the permanent joint headquarters was the right answer. Since it was set up, I mean, it has been involved in countless operations. I suspect probably 70 or 80 different operations over the period of time it's been set up, ranging in scale from relatively small things to clearly Gulf War II. And I think the thought of those operations being divvied up amongst the single service headquarters and the distraction that they would have caused would have been impossibly difficult to cope with. So I am certainly now, and have been for some time, a devotee of the permanent joint headquarters and the joint chief of joint operations structure as far as it goes. There are others who would go further with it and actually allocate full command of more of the forces available to the single services, to the joint a chief of joint operations on a full-time basis. At the moment, an operation is set up by the chief of defence staff, Operation Alpha or whatever it's called. The forces are allocated as required to that operation, and then for the duration of that operation, they come under the operational command of the chief of joint operations, but he does not have full command, and when the operation is ceased, they go back to the operational command of the commander-in-chief single service. And I think that's right and proper. There are, as I say, advocates of giving the chief of joint operations even more command responsibility, raising his rank to a 4-star rank level. And I think when you start doing that, then again you start to undermine the rationale for having commanders in chief at fleet headquarters, strike command and land command. So I think we've got it right at the moment. I wouldn't want to see it go any further. Another strand which came out of, I think, the defence cost studies, where again the Air Force came in for considerable criticism, was in its logistic support arrangements, its sort of deep engineering support. The Navy had been saying for a long time, you know, why does the Air Force need third line servicing to be done within the service? Why don't they do exactly what we have done with our third line, which is our dockyards, and privatise that? That, I think, was then and still is to a degree a simplistic argument, in as much that the dockyards, yes, they are clearly a major element of support for the Navy, but they are very static. There is no chance that you need to move that dockyard facility to the ship. The ship comes to the dockyard, and therefore I think it's right that it's privatised. But third line engineering within the Royal Air Force, A, has had to respond to much tighter time pressures than third line for the Royal Navy has had to in the past. And secondly, you have wanted to deploy elements of that third line from time to time to give you an in-theatre repair capability. And so I think the arguments were different, but nevertheless, it was something which was seen as being an overhead that we could afford to do without. And therefore, during defence cost studies, although it didn't happen at that stage, the pressure started to come on to civilianise, to contractorise, privatise, take out the uniform manpower out of third line servicing within the Royal Air Force. The other area where I think all three services lost out and was very badly handled, and we had to try and sort of do what we could, was on the medical front, DCS 19. Our medical services, and speaking for the Royal Air Force in particular, I think were harshly treated during the defence cost studies. The heart was ripped out of them because, having gone from a position where we had our own hospitals and things of that nature and excellent medical facilities, all of that was ripped out, all our hospitals went, and therefore the morale of our medical personnel was completely shattered. That said, they were to an extent their own worst enemy, because a number of studies had gone on before defence cost study trying to make the medical services more efficient, and they had always, you know, refused to look at any sort of modernisation, any efficiency measures and things of that nature, and therefore people had just got a bit tired. So for heaven's sake, we're going to cut this lot apart, and that's exactly what happened. I think the study was badly done. They didn't have any medical people on the team that did the study. They cut out all the service hospitals, and as I say, I think cut the morale of the service medical specialists particularly enormously. So many of the surgeons, anaesthetists and so forth just said, well, fine, I know, I'm better off going into private practice.
So they resigned their commission?
Yeah, just left in droves, and went to work in, you know, some of them in the NHS, but most of them in private medicine, because they could walk straight into private practice, were much wealthier, and they'd lost their hospitals, their structure, and so forth. I think we probably had too many service hospitals prior to that, and we certainly needed to streamline them. But I think to take all the service hospitals away was a great mistake.
So, two questions then, please. Who provided then the medical care for the services after this? And what happened to the infrastructure?
Well, the service hospitals were done away with.
So they were sold to the...
Closed, sold if they had a resale value, but not many of them did. I mean, in the main, they were just closed. Halton was closed, Ely was closed, Rorton was closed. Some little minor units kept on for a while. Haslar, the Navy hospital, was kept on for a while, but that's just about to close now. And in their place, they set up what they called Ministry of Defence Hospital Units. Three of them in the country. Frimley Park, in sort of Hampshire, Derriford in Devon, and at Peterborough in Leicestershire, or I think Peterborough is just in Leicestershire, or Cambridgeshire, tied a little bit to each of the services. So Peterborough was tied Air Force to a degree, Frimley Park was Army, and Derriford was Navy. And these were agreements with those three civilian hospitals in which we would provide manpower, both nursing and doctor, to work on mixed wards. So our patients would go, if they needed secondary care, would go to these hospitals and be looked after on mixed wards, where you might be looked after by a military doctor, you might be looked after by a military nurse. On the other hand, you might not be. But our personnel would operate within these civilian hospitals. Now, in some ways, for some of the doctors who didn't mind the loss of identity, actually it wasn't so bad because they got a good spread of patient care to look after, age and obviously both sexes and things of that nature. But the nurses certainly didn't like it because they joined a military nursing service to wear uniform, to perhaps have a sense of discipline and things of that nature, which was greater and sharper than their civilian counterparts. And yet suddenly they found themselves on wards with geriatrics and things of that nature, which wasn't why they had joined a military nursing service. So it meant that recruiting nurses was very difficult, and it meant that in the main, retaining doctors was difficult. So it was not a good outcome at all. And we'll come on a little bit more to that under my next tour. I think there was also, I talked about sort of, you know, the logistics support, also Defence Cost Studies saw the start of a process which was to much more centralise the personnel function, again under the central staff, to take away far more of the policy making function from the single services in the personnel area. And one saw that, for example, because out of Defence Cost Studies came the move to centralise all staff training for officers within three services within one staff college. So to do away with Camberley, Bracknell and Greenwich and put everybody together. I just come back, I think, to this relationship that the difficulty that the service had. Obviously, there had been a degree of breakdown between Mike Graydon and the Secretary of State because of this alliance of Hart and Walker undermining what he was trying to do as CAS, poisoning the atmosphere between him and the Secretary of State. And then Mike Graydon gave his speech in the Aeronautical Society, forgotten the date now, but you will know it well, where he was critical of ministers. Clearly a bold step. I think in hindsight it was probably a mistake, because although the service was delighted to hear him say so, the fact that he then not retracted, because he didn't actually retracted what he said. What he said the following day was that he apologised if what he'd said had given offence. Didn't apologise for what he'd said, but he apologised if what he'd said had given offence. But it was interpreted across the service as a climb down. Of that there's no doubt. And so suddenly, from a position where everybody was rooting for him and very pleased that he had said what he'd said, the fact that he then, on the face of it, climbed down was a bitter blow. And it's difficult. I mean, I think in hindsight, probably, he should either have not said it in the first place and struggled through, or he should have said it and then resigned. It was going to be difficult for him to resign because we, again, the service of the personality things involved here. We'd had the resignation of Peter Harding, the Chief of Defence Staff, so again that had sort of tarnished the service's reputation. John Thompson, who was clearly Graydon's successor in waiting, had died, and Sandy Wilson, who was the other Air Marshal or Air Chief Marshal who could have taken over and probably would have been a good Chief of Air Staff, certainly a determined and doughty fighter, had sadly had to resign as well over the issue of curtains and covers.